Hi, good morning. This is Kim Mooney. I'm here for my quarterly show on death, dying, grief. We talk about all the most fun things in the world, but actually they are the most important things in the world. So I want to thank KGNU again for sponsoring this. This is the only community radio station we know of in the country who thinks that this is important enough material to have turned it into a regular offering for 9 years. So it's another really good reason to support KGNU any way we can. So today I'm going to talk about queer grief. And we haven't done a show on grief for a long time, so I thought what I might do is start out and give you kind of a couple of minutes of background around grief, because it's the one thing that we don't understand in general, and we can't really talk about specific kinds of grief unless we have an overview. But first, I'd like to tell you I have two guests here today. I'm just going to start by introducing them. Bruce Parker is the deputy director at Out Boulder County. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
Do you want to say anything else about yourself?
No.
Okay. And Julia Condolora is, we've got her, a trans woman and an advocate for the trans community working with the Transgender Center of the Rockies, which is a program of the Mile High Behavioral Healthcare. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
Is there anything you would like to add about yourself?
No, I think that covers it good enough.
Okay, because we're going to be asking you a lot about your stories, and hopefully we'll have callers tell us about their stories. So I'd like to ask you just one thing very briefly, because we make a lot of assumptions. Could you describe, I think we all know when we say LGBTQIA+, I think we all could describe lesbian, gay, bisexual, but could you say two things? Could you describe a transgendered person, and could you say what cisgender means? Because there's a new vocabulary out there and a lot of people still don't get it. Bruce, do you want to handle it?
Okay.
Oh, Julia, either one.
No, go ahead, Bruce.
I think I'll let Julia go first and I'll jump in if I have anything to add about this one.
Okay. So a transgender person is anyone that was assigned a different gender at birth than they see themselves as. I guess that's the easiest way I could say it. And a cisgender person is someone who identifies as the same gender they were assigned at birth.
Perfect.
For example, I was assigned male at birth, but I see myself as a woman, so I am a trans woman.
Great. That was perfect. I think when we're looking, as I said, at any kind of specific population, it's really important to understand their experience and their language. And that's one of the ways that we get tripped up. So I'm going to back up here and just do a general overview of grief in this country, because we still don't recognize it a lot. And probably the most important thing in this show and in general is to name it and identify it. As I've said 100 times, if you don't identify something as grief, the responses to it can be so overwhelming that we want to ascribe it to something. So we say people are depressed and we put them on meds, or, you know, she's just become really bitchy instead of understanding what happened. So it's really important, and we're going to look at everything today through the lens of grief. There are psychosocial aspects to each of these things. There are political pieces. But we're going to keep coming back to grief, because this is the natural human experience that doesn't need to be fixed, and it's the one thing that we will all deal with all of our lives. So this is what I'll say about it. We live with grief all our lives. Some of it is universal, some of it is personal. It's unique to each person. So two twins who lose a mother would have very, very different losses and very different grief experiences. It is very holistic. It's not just emotional, and people who do not become highly emotional are less likely to get a lot of support. Because we don't recognize it, we can't support people in the way that's really appropriate. It changes us for better or worse. If we don't really grieve, we can be stuck in ways that will never recover the wholeness of our lives. And it is devastating. It doesn't go away, but it does change as we go through time. And this is important, because once again, we kind of accuse people of not getting over things, when in fact that grief is transforming their lives and they are integrating it over a long period of time. So the process changes. And what we find is that the things that we thought we could not live through after an acute loss are things that we can. We learn to integrate them. So there are a lot of people who somaticize. They don't cry. It's fine. We learn that kids grieve differently. That's really important. And we learn by either studying grief or we learn by listening to each other's stories, because that normalizes it. And it also gives us a really good sense of what it means to be, to have your life fall apart in ways that you may not articulate. So particularly one thing I want to say about this, that we're going to look at different aspects of grief today. And there are two that are really important. Grief in general is really important, but disenfranchised grief is the kind of grief where we don't recognize or we refuse to recognize someone's loss or their response to the loss. There's always a reason we can deny it. So you're not supposed to grieve an ex-wife. She's not important anymore. Suicide, abortion gets stigmatized. It was their choice. They don't have a right to grieve. Miscarriage, you can always have another one. So being born in a body that doesn't match who you are is a It's an intense grief, but also is having to try to convince other people that that's who you are. Abusive relationships are frequently disenfranchised. When an abuser dies, well, hey, he's not there anymore. It's all over. But you also get to grieve the losses of the years you didn't have, or the sense of the lack of safety that you had, or the ways that your self-esteem were destroyed. And I think the reason this is important is for all of us to understand that it's complicated. And we can grieve something that we love. We can also grieve something that we didn't like. And we're not used to dealing with those contrary emotions. So we disenfranchise ourselves. We're the ones who say, I can't possibly feel bad at the same time I'm relieved. And so the queer community is disenfranchised anybody, anyway. We're marginalized, but we're using the word disenfranchised because that is the language that we want to identify through. We want to identify it as grief responses. The other thing is that it's important when we're talking about grief to talk about what we call competitive grief, because people will often say, oh, my grief was a lot worse than yours. My loss was worse. Or it was only my aunt. I can't compare that to yours. And the truth is, your broken heart or your destroyed world is yours, and that's the most important. So nobody gets to tell anybody else what's important or how to grieve. So a child who's brought up in a war-torn country has specific aspects of their life and trauma that they will have to deal with. But is that any worse than a woman who has miscarried six times and been told each time that it's not important? So really important that we don't look at competitive grief. And the third thing that we're going to talk about with this community particularly is ambiguous loss. And these are the kinds of losses that aren't clear or maybe are never resolved, like soldiers who are missing in action. Are they gone? Are they still around? And we just don't know it. You know, that kind of haunting, ambiguous loss. And I've seen this in the queer community is parents saying, we don't know. We lost our son, but did we really lose our son? Who is this person? Our family's changed. And I'll tell you a story a little bit later about a friend of mine who had a very clear story about losing his son that way. So I'd like to stop now. I just needed to lay that groundwork. And I want to unpack this with both Julie and Bruce by asking you to tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up. What was it like to not be able to be yourself? And also, just tell me a little bit about, because I'm naming griefs along the way, and we'll all do a drum roll when we get to the part of the story where everybody has about coming out. So one of you, would you like to just tell us about your whole life? But just in terms of what it means to be grieving who you weren't allowed to be.
So I guess I can go first. I'm Bruce Parker without Boulder County. I moved here about a year ago, and my life started in Pikeville, Kentucky. And my father passed away when I was two. And so I grew up in a house that actually had a lot of grief in it, and that was hyper present. We lived next to his parents and his sister. And so sort of the notion of grieving what I never had, and someone that they and my mother lost, was just a part of our daily lives, actually, like sort of throughout my time in elementary school and junior high. And I think confronting all of that while also dealing with sort of my identity and what became clear to me in terms of my attractions, like around seventh grade or so, conflated a lot. And so as I thought through like how to live my life and to tell my family, I just knew that it would break my mother's heart because she thought things were already too hard for me because of not having a father. So there was this sort of compounding anxiety for me about coming out. I think that probably because I found my way to being out as queer in the seventh grade, eighth grade, and I developed super strong friendships throughout high school, I don't actually grieve missing a lot of that time because of my identity. I'm actually like grateful that I had the connections I had with other queer youth during that time. And so I think I got to largely live as who I was. There are things like my relationship with my mother that is now super strong and we talk every day. But growing up, that was not the case because I felt like I had to hide something from her pretty aggressively and that she was super judgmental once I told her, which she was, but she came around fairly quickly. And so I think on the whole, like that part of my experience was okay. And I didn't confront grief about my identity. I just confronted it in sort of ways that circled throughout my environment nonstop. And maybe as we talk later, I had the experience of living with a roommate who had lost 32 people to AIDS during the 80s when I was in college. And so that notion of living with grief sort of came back. And I have spent 2 years sort of living with him while he was dealing with some of that in the late 90s.
So I think one of the biggest aspects for at least kids, my brother was gay and he didn't come out for a long time. And when he does, we were incredibly relieved that that's, quote, all it was. But, you know, when he talked later about what it was like to hide when he was young, can you say a little bit more about that? You know, I want to talk about how people feel, but also recognize that there's so much more than just the feelings. You know, there the experience of not being safe or, I mean, it's hard for a teenager who has acne to not belong. And I think one of the aspects of the, when we're talking about queer grief, is feeling like you never completely belonged, which is different than feeling like you wouldn't be, you know, you would be shunned or something, just the feeling of not being part of it. So can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
And maybe Julia, like, had more of that experience. I think, you know, I was in a documentary when I was in high school about being queer in Eastern Kentucky because it's a conservative area. There weren't very many queer people who were out. And they cut my parts on the documentary because I wasn't unhappy. So when they interviewed me about my experiences and I talked about sort of like the strength of community that I found, meeting people who were like me from different schools in the county and how I spent all my free time with those people and we had strong relationships that were artistic and creative and supportive, I just didn't actually have a lot of time spent feeling like I was hiding who I was. Mm-hmm. I think that I sort of like pretty vocally accepted myself and ended up having a very good experience in a very conservative place. You know, I think, and I mentioned this earlier, that the exception to that would be, I don't think I hid from my mother, but I think we worked very hard to not talk about it.
Okay.
And so it feels like there were pieces of myself and our relationship that weren't what they could have been at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I grieve that and think about that still, although I think we've caught up and our relationship is better. But I think my experience is not common. Mm-hmm. I think that it's sort of, and there are a lot of ways growing up queer in Eastern Kentucky with a single mother and in poverty, like being queer may have been what saved my life. It's maybe why I don't still live there and work at kind of a dead end job. Like I knew I had to make different choices to be happy. And so, yeah, I don't think I had a lot of isolation at that age. Maybe Julia, maybe you had a different experience than me.
No, actually my experience was not typical of most trans people. You know, I didn't really figure out exactly what was going on until I was in my mid-20s probably, and not really thinking I could do anything about it until I was maybe 50 years old. So my experience growing up was fairly happy. You know, and I never felt I was hiding anything from anybody because I didn't really know what was going on with myself. There was something going on, but I didn't have the words I have now to totally explain it all. And that was an unfortunate thing. And what your listeners don't know is I'm 69 years old. So this was in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, there just wasn't a whole lot of information out there. And you really had to dig to find it. And I didn't do that. So I was more or less just confused about myself more than I was hiding things or and you know, I was also just trying to fit in. I was a smaller kid, so I got bullied a little bit because of that. And you know, it wasn't a perfect life, but you know, whatever feelings I did have, I repressed them.
Okay.
And that's probably the one thing I might say that I grieve about that time is that I didn't know and I didn't get to be to even think about being an authentic person. I just knew that there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Not actually, but at the time, that's what I felt.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is cool because these are two, I want to say, atypical experiences, but you didn't awfulize, as we like to say, everything. You know, you're very lucky in a lot of ways. I know that there are people, but it's not typical. I mean, it's not 100% that the coming out process or the hiding was horrible. So thank you for breaking the mold right away. I do want to say, also speaking for those people who talk a lot about how hard it was coming out, if you have other examples that would be really helpful, I want to tell a little bit about how it was for my brother, who says he knew that something was different about him, but he categorized it as something being wrong since he was about 4. And we talked about what that was like for him to hide, but what it was like for him to not be able to do the things that were expected of him and the way he got bullied. I beat kids up until he was about 15. No, I was 15. And I didn't know why they were so mean to him. And I think that there was in Omaha growing up a real sense that Michael was different. As I said, we were so relieved when he finally came out because he'd hidden so much that we thought he was, you know, smuggling drugs across the border or something. He'd disappear for days. And but when he came out, he actually was really articulate about what it was like for him, how hard it was for him when all the girls were chasing him and the masquerades he had to put on to try to look normal. We, as his family, had to grieve all those years that we didn't have him with us comfortably. And nobody really thought about that. We were all a very loving family. If Michael had told us when he was 6 that something was strange about him, we would have been there for him. But his experience was really different than ours. And so it's more typical of what you hear when you think about the, you know, the hard coming out stories or having to come out to your wife and kids. Yeah. So what other experiences can you talk about from the community, people that you work with? Because you're Boulder County is an amazing community.
You know, I can personalize it even. It goes so far as to say that a partner that I've been with for 12 years now was raised Catholic in Louisiana and came out to his family maybe just a year ago, a year and a half ago. And he is 32 now. And I think they probably knew, but he had the experience of not communicating with them or sort of not having a good relationship with them and carrying a lot of discomfort today. A lot of discomfort sort of with them. And he eventually, as he came out to them, he came out to them about our relationship as well. And his mother, I think, doesn't want him to go to hell. And so she has like really discontinued communication basically. And then when he let her know that we were moving across the country to Colorado for my job, she burst into tears and wouldn't talk to him. And they haven't really talked since. Mm-hmm. And that's been a year. And so I think the loss that he continues to feel is pretty severe and real for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And within that, if we unpack it, I think one of the things that's important is that grief is not always what we think of as acute grief attached to an event, highly emotional, that it follows us throughout our lives. So when you're talking about that, and I'm thinking about my brother, even reflecting backward, and I think, Julie, it was you that I was talking to at some point about looking backward and realizing you didn't get to go to prom. You know, all the things that are, whether they were very bad or they were just slight, there's a way that we can mourn what we didn't have in our lives at the same time we can really celebrate what we did. So that sense of holding both at the same time is really important, because if we can't, it's another way we disenfranchise what our experience was about, which is always pretty profound. But I think unpacking it gives us permission to be more of who we have always been and who grief is making us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we talk about disenfranchised grief, I have a story about a friend of mine, Steve, who was, I think he was about 34 when he had to tell his wife and his three kids when he decided to come out. There, for him, there was no one waiting, which I think is also really important. He was stepping over the threshold from his old life into this world that he had no idea what he was going to be dealing with, but he'd waited a very long time and had been living, basically manufacturing a personality all the time, every day. And so when he decided to come out, he knew, he'd prepared for a long time for what he was going to be dealing with, and still wasn't really prepared for the reactions of each of his family, which were pretty nasty. He lost his kids, but that, again, was sort of what we would call an ambiguous loss, because they kept in a little bit of touch with him. They didn't stay in great touch with him. So he always had that sense that at some point they would take him back. Always had a little bit of a hook in there. And for years, he held on to that. So he was between the worlds. So to say, he would say, you know, I've come to grips with that. And then he would talk more about his kids. And it was clear that he thought he should have come to grips with it, but it was an ongoing loss for him. It was an ongoing loss not to be able to see his kids have grandkids. And so he sort of understands now that he personally will never really stop grieving all of the things he lost with that life. But he's also very grateful for where he is now.
I think for the queer community, there's such a strong connection between shame and grief.
Hmm.
I think that sort of grief, one of the ways that grief manifests around those types of losses is like there's a lot of shame attached to it. You feel like you, even if you're doing the right things for you, who you are or the choices you're making are pushing people away from you. And shame's a dangerous feeling, and grief can be just the heaviest feeling there is, maybe. And so I see so many people sort of navigating what it means to still be ashamed of who they are, who they love, not necessarily because of their actions, but because of how it has impacted their relationships with other people and the opportunities and experiences they've lost. And so I think in both cases, the answer is probably something like the same. And I think like the antidote to shame and the antidote to that kind of grief probably looks a lot like honesty, like with yourself and with others about who you are and your experiences, sort of being able to name with some detail what it means to grieve that time that your friend lost with his children, like, and the ways that he feels responsible for that,
mm-hmm.
knowing that he's not, that those are choices they made. But I just don't know, as a community, we have to get better at helping people untangle shame and grief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I will say that being a part of many support groups over the years, that there are just a tremendous amount of trans people that, you know, by the time they decided they had to come out and transition, they were married, they had kids, or, you know, girlfriends or boyfriends, and most of them lost everything. You know, their wives or husbands left them. Some of them lost their family. And it's just a hard thing, you know? And, you know, they don't want to blame it on themselves, but yet they precipitated all of this stuff happening. And while you can sit in support groups and say, listen, it's not your fault for wanting to be authentic, you know, but they still see that all of a sudden their kids don't want to talk to them anymore, or or they're getting a divorce, and it's just tough. It's very tough on people.
I'm just jumping in at the top of the hour. We have to do a station ID. You're listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver, and this is a call-in show. So if you have something to offer to the discussion or questions to ask, you can do so at 303-442-4242.
Great. Thank you both. You know, if I unpack that, because that's also, again, we don't want to just stamp something as grief. When I think about all of the different kinds of grief, the primary and then what we call secondary griefs, things that come out of it, like, for example, coming out to a family where you have kids, there is exactly, Bruce, what you said. There are feelings about your responsibility. There's not just losing your place at the table. There's losing, you know, your relationship with each one of those people. You're losing your position, your relationship as the father who's supposed to be taking care of them. You're losing your daily relationship with them, but you also lose future relationships with your grandkids. I mean, you start to unpack it and you realize that there are many things about each one of those losses that you may not recognize or honor that much, but it goes on. Anytime in the human experience, we are in a position where we are huge pack animals, where we are separated, where we are made to feel that we don't belong, there is a natural grief around that. And that, I think, is that's the beginning of all this. That's why the healing piece for most of us is the stories, is the re-blending of ourselves with, you know, the rest of the world. So finding people in support groups. Support groups have saved people's lives, much more than therapy, I think. Sitting in rooms and hearing other people's stories and having them validate you. And sometimes that's what happens in a support group is as you start to talk, you start to feel all of the different things or identify all of the different things that have gone into that kind of a loss. The one that comes up a lot for me, moving this out a little bit, is an abusive relationship. That they say that even if you make a positive change, it can change your place on it. Insurance actuarial scale, because the stress of change is so intense. And there were people in a grief group that I did that was not specifically around abuse, but two women particularly who said, "What is wrong with me? I'm crazy." And this is another part of grief. There is actually what they call the going crazy syndrome. How can I feel all these things? I understand in my head what's going on, but my body's doing a really different number here. And so the contradictions of who you are now and what you had to give up to get there. With this abused woman, she really didn't understand why she could feel so bad about never having a chance to get back at this man, never having a chance to get any kind of reconciliation, never having a chance to get this man to love her. He had died. And that confusion, I think, is huge. So when you look at it as your personal confusion, your personal grief, and then we move it into community grief, that's one of the hardest parts, I think, in any community is, you know, here's what happened to me personally, and people telling to you, well, you turned out okay, and what's the problem? You know, why are you still thinking about this?
I keep thinking about, like, sort of three interconnected things. And, I had two friends who were both queer. These are my people, right? And they're in West Virginia. Like, they're visiting West Virginia last month, and talking a lot about how they're homesick for West Virginia, even though they live here now. And then it inspired me to find a book about a man who lives in Portland, Oregon, who's from the part of Kentucky that I'm from, who wrote sort of like a meditation on grieving for Kentucky. And so he sort of based, there's a chapter off of each county of Kentucky, and he talks about things that he misses, and he weaves in history and weaves in conversations with his wife. And they feel exiled from the space because there's not opportunity for them and their kid. Like, I think queer people oftentimes have to grieve geography in places they were born, because small towns don't always have a space for people who are different, have careers or have lives or define community. So there's this shared experience for a lot of queer people from rural areas about grieving home. Like, you left, but you didn't feel like you had a choice, really. And so there's a collectivity to that that is interesting, that I think also comes forward every year during Transgender Day of Remembrance, which I can let Julia talk more about. Mm-hmm. And I think it also comes around with HIV and AIDS sort of issues. And so when COVID started, and then when monkeypox came up again, whole chunks of the LGBT community, particularly gay men, just felt like, oh no, here we go again. And felt sort of re-traumatized, triggered, sort of this collective weight of, we've seen the government fail us before and have our people pass away. They're not going to care because it's only impacting us in terms of monkeypox. And so just so many people that I interact with and deal with were taken right back to that experience of the AIDS epidemic in a way that I had never thought about, but it just really demonstrated for me sort of collective bonds of grief that cross those folks. Mm-hmm. And for people in my generation, it kind of awoke the grief we had about not having our elders, like not having like all of the gay men who passed away during the 80s and early 90s from AIDS are the people who would be one generation above me. And so we sort of were robbed of a lot of our community and leaders in that way. So you find yourself grieving for people you don't even know that you wish you could have known. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know, Julia, do you want to talk about maybe the collectivity of TDOR?
I'm sure. You know, it's November 20th, and it's a very tough time of the year for trans people. It's where we mourn the people that passed due to violence. This year there was 36, if you count four from last year, that happened after November 20th. And it's really horrible. And it attacks a certain segment of our population more than others. I think 31 of the 36 people were people of color, and mostly trans women. There are a few trans men in there as well. And, you know, I'm not sure if we're really counting all the non-binary people that are probably also murdered. A lot of these things are really hard because when these murders happen, they're not seen, you know, the people are misgendered, they're dead named. And, you know, it takes somebody in the community to come out and say, no, this person was a woman or a man, not the opposite. So, yeah, and just in case anybody wants to participate in this, the LGBT Center on Colfax will be having a reading of the names, which is something we do every year. It's from 6 to 8 on Friday, 11/18, and their address is 1301 East Colfax. And then the Transgender Center of the Rockies will be doing the same thing, having the reading of the names at the Space Annex, which is 95 Cherokee Street, and that will be on 11/19 Saturday from 4 to 6. And I know that Boulder County is having one as well, so you might give that time.
Yeah, Out Boulder County is having ours on Sunday, November 20th from 6:30 to 8:30, and it will be at our Equality Center of the Rocky Mountains. And so you can find the address and the details at outboulder.org, or if you're on our newsletter, it'll be featured in it this Thursday.
Okay, great, great.
And having been somebody that's prepared the list of names every year for the past few years, I can tell you that is a very, very difficult task to look at the pictures and read descriptions about their lives. And then, you know, it's just a horrible thing.
I choke up thinking about it, Julia. I got my start doing LGBT activism, doing trans activism. I was partnered with a trans man for 7 years in my early 20s. And TDOR was the first community event I ever attended. And then it ended up being the first community event I ever helped organize. And I just don't know that at that time I had ever experienced anything sadder than sort of a collective funeral for people who were lost to violence because of who they are. And like for me, like for people who haven't been to it, a thing to understand about this is one of the sort of tropes about it that is a consistent thing no matter where you go is there's some sort of presentation of the names of the people that we lost. And some places will sort of present the names and say how they were killed, stabbed to death, burned in a trash bag, like just these awful things that you hear out loud. And then there's so many of the names each year that you don't have names for. So it'll say unknown trans woman. And I think those two pieces together, the notion of hearing the ways that the violence happened, and so many of those folks not knowing their names and not knowing if their family knows what happened to them or who they had or if their people knew what happened to them, just sat with me. And I think it's probably why I went on to have a career doing this stuff to build community, because I just found it haunting. So the 2 years that I sort of helped organize those events, I just cried through the whole event because I don't know that there's anything sadder than that. And it really pushed me to want to be a part of things like Out Boulder County that are trying to make the world safer and better for LGBT people, with an emphasis on young LGBT people, trans LGBT people, and queer and trans people of color, because those are the folks that are at the most risk of harm.
Great. That's a really good example of the depth and the intensity of a grief process. That there are, things that happen that are horrendous, however we want to frame that, and it takes facing it, which is what happens when you actually do a reading of names. It's hard, it's uncomfortable, but you bring it into the room and you honor people and you face listening to things you don't like. And through that, moving through that, then oftentimes most people come through and feel like and change. And although it sounds Pollyanna, for many people, moving through a grief process changes them in a positive way. I would never say that to anybody who's in the middle of an intense process. But at the end, we often find that our values have shifted. So thank you, because that's a really good example of process.
And I'm jumping in from operating the board to ask a question. And you too can ask a question at 303-442-4242. But I want just to dig a bit deeper into what you brought up, Bruce, and also what you just said, Kim, about the way of processing grief when you can make a change of it. And I'm asking this because I'm moving here from Mexico and covered a lot of collective grief issues while there. And something that really always struck with me when looking at issues of femicide in Ciudad Juárez, for example, a healthcare provider in Ciudad Juárez who kind of ended up, she was a social worker and ended up really working on issues of femicide through providing social services. She said the people who are able to process the grief in a healthier, and I hate the word resilience, but a healthier, more resilient way, are the people who become activated afterwards. People who say, I am not going to let this happen to somebody else's daughter, right? And you see this with also the cases of missing, how you were talking about ambiguous grief. That's huge in Mexico, where you have literally tens of thousands of missing persons cases since the start of the militarization of the drug war. So you have entire collectives of families who sit with their grief in a way, but they process it through, we're going to make sure this doesn't happen to other people, either by raising awareness or by conducting public searches where you all get together on a Saturday and maybe you bring the media along for a degree of protection and you go out to areas where perhaps you've gotten a tip that bodies are buried, right? And so this, going back to this social worker, she said that there are people who sit with their grief in a way that where it just eats them up from the inside and having very serious health implications. But those who tend to not suffer the internal health effects of this traumatic stress are the ones who decide that they're going to participate in events that raise awareness or that in some way act as a preventative mechanism to avoid the continuation of the situation so others don't have to live with the same type of grief.
Yes. I think the word resilient is a good word, actually, because we avoid medical terms. I never say that you heal from grief. But moving through, this is true of
Yeah,
humanity.
no, I get it. And it's adequate. It's the best you know, sometimes it's the best word, but I feel like my issue with that particular word is when it's used as a dismissive kind of, they can take it. They can take it. So let's just keep throwing it at them. Right. That's where I have my issue with the word resilience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's why I think it's important to study grief, because the language of it and the studies have actually shown that most people will move through an acute grief and find health again with support. They don't need therapy. They don't need, you know, but the language is really important. And so when we think about anything else, resilience means that you can deal with something that's difficult and use your resources to move through it. And so one of the things we often say, and this comes up with all kinds of grief, not just queer grief, is what have you done in the past that's helped you before this? You know, are you a resilient human being? Are you somebody who collapses? Because we want to look at this as a natural process. Well, we've lived through many things before. So I think language is a whole fascinating conversation. But in the populations that you're talking about, there are a lot of similarities with the queer community, and that is that underlying all these community griefs, there is disdain, there is a prejudice, there are a lot of assumptions that happens. There is always the threat of violence.
And impunity. That's yes. Another thing. It's like where, you know, people can be targeted mm-hmm. with impunity, and society sits by and says, eh.
Yeah. Yeah. And that in itself, I think, is a huge grief, to always know that you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, that you don't belong.
I think I struggle with, so that you named very clearly how I came to be who I am and how my life looks how it looks, right? Sort of confronting grief and then sort of discrimination led me to be an activist. It's hard for me to argue that that is the only healthy way to process grief, or even necessarily a healthy way. There are ways in which I still haven't let some of that go or processed through that pain. And that's why I'm still doing what I'm doing and feel a sense of urgency about it. And so I just wonder if sort of healthy grieving can also look like remembering that you love to dance and going dancing every Thursday with other people like you at an LGBT bar, or like really settling into writing letters to your best friend about your experience. And so I'm hesitant, because I think that one of the things that happens to marginalized people is there is this expectation of action. Like, you have to be an activist. You have to fight for your rights. You have to stand up for people like you. You have to like change the world. And that is who I am. That's what I've embraced as my identity. There's also has to be a space for it to be okay for LGBT people to want to have a job and have a kid and play volleyball on the weekend and read a book, and that be just as valid of a way of living. And so I'm hesitant to think the only way through grief is sort of with a bias towards action. I think we all have to find our own ways and hopefully mm-hmm. find it in community.
I will totally
really agree with that.
Yeah. And I do too. I do too. I think that we see in communities where there's potential violence that people often tend to move more toward action as part of their return to the world. But on a smaller scale, this is really a good thing to bring up, Bruce. On a smaller scale, when people are resilient and they move through, I'm going to say through because we don't move away from it. We integrate a grief and we become a different person. Sometimes what that looks like is just, in healthy people, learning to be more compassionate with other people, or living your life in a more meaningful way, or learning, you know, what it means to listen to somebody differently. So that's action also, in the sense that we're talking about it, is that you move back into the world in some way, shape, or form. There's a piece here, so thank you for that, because it's true. And it's not just the queer community, it's that most of the communities, like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, started by a woman who had no justice when her kid was killed by a drunk driver. But no, you don't have to be an activist to prove. This is important, because a lot of people do feel like that. What have I done? What do I need to do to give back? But I want to break this out here, because we are talking also about, in all of these communities, what Shannon brought up also, trauma, which is different than grief. And there is a traumatized aspect anytime that there is a sense that there could be violence, anytime you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And trauma is not like grief. Trauma, grief, we're all going to live with. It moves through us. It's part of being human. A traumatized experience honestly gets stuck in us. It needs, oftentimes, most of the time, some kind of professional help or a different kind of a more sophisticated lens to be able to move through it. And if you don't understand that, then you feel like you're really screwing up because you're not, quote, getting over it. So I want to keep breaking that out. And it's really important that trauma engenders a whole different kind of fear. You can't just move through it naturally by assuming that, you know, it's going to go away. And I see that in almost all the communities that we deal with where there's any kind of violence, any kind of ongoing, like you're talking about monkeypox, bringing back up what was a very violent period, I think, for the, at that point, we would call it the gay community for my brother. So really good point, and really want to break out the difference between trauma and grief. And thank you.
Yeah, and trauma is something that, you know, like as when I presented as a male, I never felt fear going anywhere at any time of the day. It just was something I never even thought about, where all of a sudden now, just even presenting as a woman, you have to look at the world in a different way. You can't just walk down the street at night by yourself. You know, when you go to your car, you want to have your key out already and be all ready to jump in and lock the doors. You know, it's just it's a whole different mindset. And having known people that were attacked and assaulted in Denver, it just changes your whole mindset about everything in your life. And that's kind of a collective trauma that I think all trans people feel.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, if we want to break that out, I think all women feel that way, too, in a way that it's hard for other people to understand. Sometimes my husband is a wonderful man, but when I tried to talk to him about carrying my keys between my fingers in San Francisco, he sympathized with me, but he has no idea. He can't understand the experience of being that afraid all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's partly why I think it's important to study. It is the understanding from the inside of what it is that someone else might be going through that would never even occurred to you was a big deal. So...
Kim, you mentioned, like, so I have a question for you, actually. You sort of were, I think, I'm interested in the fact that I think I've talked about shame, like, you brought up trauma, and, like, Julia gave such a good example of how that works, and grief, right? Like, maybe talk about where trauma and grief can overlap for people, I think.
Okay, well, because I'm a grief person, I see it everywhere. It isn't depressing to me because it is depressing, but it's not something to be avoided. I guess that I would say. So you can grieve many things throughout your life that have no trauma to them. Trauma, the way we define it really simply is helplessness and horror. The trauma happens when we feel like there's nothing we can do. So Or it's overwhelming. So they would consider watching a plane wreck traumatic as well as the grief that you would feel for all the different things that happen. When somebody's in a traumatic situation, it's really impossible to just address the grief without talking about and working with the trauma because it sort of underlines everything. So usually when you're working with an event like that, you're vacillating back and forth. How is this affecting you? What is it about? You know, grief doesn't necessarily mean that you have to break out the responses separately. So in a traumatic situation, you may have startle response. You may not be able to sleep. You may be activated constantly, you know, in different ways. So someone who can help you break that out and say, no, it's normal not to be able to sleep, or those nightmares are not the same. It has to be on, both of them have to be honored separately. Sometimes they don't overlap at all, but if there is trauma, there's grief. Having grief doesn't necessarily mean that anything is traumatic. There's also a difference between crisis. So what I might consider traumatic, you might not. You might consider a crisis that you know how to get through. And that's why I think it's important, again, to name it for each individual person, because the response to it is going to be different, and therefore the reactions, the way to get through it is going to be different. Is that clear?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
What else? Well, if you think so, I didn't do a very good job of explaining it.
I keep thinking about during the height of the pandemic, I had an exceedingly rough personal experience that I'm not going to talk about in detail on the radio, although all of your listeners are wonderful. I had a cancer scare and had to have sort of a tumor removed from my arm that was not cancerous. And right as COVID started, like the first week, I lost a staff member that I supervised to COVID. And she was a young woman of color who had an intellectual disability. And I feel like I went a little crazy, to be honest. Like, I feel like the three things together sort of became this enmeshment of sort of grief and anxiety. And I spent the 3 months that summer, like, riding my bicycle or walking, like, 20 miles a day. Or like riding my bicycle for 8 hours to kind of process through it. And it sort of, in looking back at it, like it evokes for me, like Joan Didion in A Year of Magical Thinking, a memoir that she wrote about her husband passing away. She talks about how he had a heart attack and passed away. And when she went back to the apartment after dealing with it, she cleared out his stuff, but she never got rid of his shoes for 2 years because in her head, she couldn't get out of thinking like, when he comes back, he'll need shoes. And that was the only item that is sort of stuck with her that way. And they were his favorite running shoes. And so I just keep thinking about how there is like, obviously spaces inside of grief that don't feel normal that we also have to work through, or sort of, I don't know, is there such a thing as traumatic grief, or is there sort of like, how does that work for people? Was, I guess, what I was trying to get to.
Yeah. There is there, and there's one of the distinguishing points. First, let me say that what you're talking about with the shoes is totally normal. It's part of why we say people, it's not just an emotional process. Everybody goes through some part, not everybody, thinking that they're going crazy, waiting for their daughter to walk in the door, thinking that they hear somebody, not being able to, thinking that they're hallucinating. There are lots of different parts of that need to be normalized. What you're talking about, I think, in your situation is complicated or complex grief, where you have so many losses in a row that you can't process one. You can't go down and sit and be completely decimated and process one because the other one's there and it pops up. And the coping skills for that are different. You don't try to get down and really process it. You kind of tread. Thank you. One syllable, still couldn't get to it, you know. So I wouldn't say necessarily. I would unpack that with you to see if there were any things in it that were traumatizing. What's lingering? Do you have images that you can't get out of your mind? What's left? That's left that would be different than the fact that you just had a ton of losses. And as we talked about secondary losses, each one of those losses had a lot of different things in it, not seeing the person that you were working with every day. If we break it down, but you had three. So a complex loss means you never really get to go down comfortably and resolve one of them. That's how I would describe that. So we've got 2 minutes left. And a lot more we could cover. Is there anybody who wants to call in? Anybody have a story or a question? You're going to have to talk fast. Okay. So, yes, no?
No, I was just saying, thank the guests. Yeah. The guests for really, thank you for such smart, nuanced points. This has been such a healthy conversation to have, mm-hmm. and so informative. And I just want to thank Kim Mooney for always bringing these nuanced conversations, and both of the guests for sharing your viewpoints, your experiences, and your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. I want to just say, Boulder County, very, very healthy community, robust, some amazing offerings there that do two things. They address issues, but they also just provide the kind of communities, as Bruce was saying, places where you can laugh, places where you can dance better than I could ever dance. But the community creates safety, and the community creates, awareness. So you can, anyway, look at their website. This interview, and they have other resources that we put together on there. There will be a grief blog. But recognize that community, having community that's open, that thinks like that, that is willing to embrace you without you even having to talk about it, that's how we move through this. That's how we integrate grief and become people who do look at their life with a different kind of resilience. true of everybody. So thank you. Thanks, KJ and Yi, once again. And Julie and Bruce, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I feel like we didn't have enough time. So if you ever want to do this again.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And for me to hear we didn't have enough time and people want to talk about it more, that's a reward unto itself. So great. Bruce.
Kim, talking to you is always delightful. Thank you for having me. And Julia, I'm sure we will interact again sometime. These communities are small.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure.
Okay. Everybody have safe, good holidays, whatever that means to you. Take good care.